Those are my kids, by the way, if anybody didn't know that. That'd be super awkward. Hey, will you read scripture in church so CJ can give you a creepy hug and a kiss? Anyways, I love them. I'm proud of them. Good morning, church family. How's everybody doing? Happy almost Thanksgiving, the most underrated holiday of all the holidays. Today is kind of a subtly significant day. Today is actually the last Sunday before Advent, which means it's the very end of the lectionary year. Next Sunday, the beginning of Advent, is the beginning of the Christian calendar. So today is, at least as far as Christian liturgy goes, the end of the year. Now, when you end something, you don't typically like end it abruptly and drop the mic randomly and just walk away. Typically, you end one thing, laying the groundwork for the next thing. You want to end one cycle, preparing people's minds and hearts for the next cycle. So, as we prepare for Advent and Christmas, the new year and the incarnation, what is it that the wise saints before us want us to see? What ideas and images do they want fresh in our minds as we begin a new year and as we enter into Advent? Based on our readings this morning, does anyone want to wager a guess as to what the central theme of this Sunday is in the lectionary? Anyone? No one? Christ the King. That's pretty much where I was going. Or in general, kingship, royalty, king. Every single text that we just read was about the king, a king, kingship, kings of the past, and the king of the future, and the paradoxical reality that Jesus is that king. But in the eyes of the world, he really doesn't look like a king. As we prepare for Advent, clearly, the thing that the lectionary wants us to think about most is kings. What is a king? What does it mean to be a king? And what does it mean that this child that is coming is a king? The king. So today, we're talking about kings, and what better way to talk about something on a family Sunday than with a Kahoot? So, get out your phones, or your laptop computer, or desktop computer if you brought it in a satchel, whatever works. Get it out and go to kahoot.it, kahoot.it, and enter the game code when it comes up. So, we usually like to have the games up on the screens there, and I do think we have kind of a graphic that we can put behind me. But we have some technological difficulties that prevents that, so we're still going to have to just work from my computer here and your phones there in front of you. So here we go. King's Kahoot, you are going to need to load in the game pin that I will tell you in just a moment. 600118. 600118. And as you do that, then you're going to need to pick a moderately church-appropriate screen name. Then again, I don't know if you can see them. Only I will know if it's inappropriate since we don't have the whole screen thing going on. So, Legend Possum. That's a fun one. Flame? Cool. Bold Ferret. Who's Bold Ferret? I have to know. Oh, come on. Own it, chickens. All right, we'll give you a few more minutes for everything to come up. And just to give you kind of like a lay of the land as we do this Kahoot, all the questions are about kings. The first few are going to be softball questions about fictional kings, but then we're going to get into biblical kings, and the questions are going to get hard because I make my Kahoots hard. Are we ready? I still see a few names popping up. We've now got a ferret in there also. We got a llama. Llama Dama Dingo. Huh? Repeat the game pin, 600-118. 600-118. All right, are we good? Are we ready? Let's get it rolling. There are 10 questions. All right, here we go. Our King's Kahoot. There we go. We got some music in the background for us. Question number one. At the end of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, how many kings and queens are there in Narnia? Is it one, two, three, or four? All right, the answer was four. 39 of you got that right, which is pretty good. All right, we're gonna skip the leaderboard all the time. Which of the Pevensey children is named High King or Queen in Narnia? Jadis, Edmund, Lucy, or Peter? Bonus points if you know who Jadis is. The White Witch, very good. You don't actually get any bonus points, but thank you. All right, the answer is Peter. Only 29 of you got that one right. All right, I'll update you at about five. In The Lord of the Rings, who is the rightful king of Gondor? Is it Theoden, Aragorn, Sauron, or Gandalf? I'll update you on the leaderboard after about five questions. The answer is Aragorn. Very good. 46 of you got that one right. Question four. What fabled king ruled over the Knights of the Round Table in Camelot? Is it King George, King Triton, King Arthur, or Lord Farquaad? All right, the answer is King Arthur. 54 of you got that one right. That one was apparently easy. All right, all this easy nonsense is coming to an end. Maybe not. In the Bible, who was the first king of Israel? Is it David, Solomon, Saul, or Charles? Okay, the answer was King Saul. Only 26 of you got that right. Next question. All right, after five questions, oh snap, Abigail S. is on the top of the leaderboard. Oh, it's not you? Okay, it's Abigail S., Beast, and MacGuffin. All right, yeah, I was proud, and then I just, you know, my worldview came crashing down. Okay. Question number six. For how many generations will all Israel be unified under a Davidic monarchy? That's a convoluted question. Is it 2, 12, 22, or 32? How many generations was Israel unified under Davidic monarch? 2, 12, 22, or 32? The answer was 2, and only 9 of you got that one right. Man, come on, y'all. All right, O Canada is in the lead. That shouldn't count, by the way, if that's you. According to 1 Kings 11, how many wives of royal birth did King Solomon have? 1, 7, 70, or 700? The answer is 724 of you got that one right. Apparently that was more memorable than Saul. All right, I'm not counting O Canada, so B and Beast are in the lead. After King Solomon, there are 39 kings of Israel and Judah. How many are viewed as good kings in the Bible? Is it 4, 14, 24, or 34? Again, of 39. Is it 4, 14, 24, or 34? How many good kings does 1 Kings, 1 and 2 Kings tell us there were of Judah and Israel? The answer is 40, or excuse me, the answer is 4, and 40 of you got that right, which is surprising. Well done. Okay, next one. Question 9, what empire conquered Judah and ended the line of Davidic kings in Jerusalem? Is it Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, or Rome? The answer is Babylon, and 34 of you got it right. Much to the consternation of the congregation, apparently. All right, so we have the leaderboard is Beast, Leo DeGrants, and O Canada, who doesn't count, so MacGuffin is third. All right, here we go. Final question, question number 10. Which Jewish holiday celebrates the Maccabean revolts, which led to the brief restoration of monarchy in Judea? Is it Rosh Hashanah, Passover, Sukkot, or Hanukkah? The answer was Hanukkah. 25 of you got that right. All right, well done. Third place was Funky. Who's Funky? Raise your hand. Okay, good job, you don't get a prize. Oh, Canada, you don't count. First place, which is the only one that gets prizes because I don't give prizes to first losers, is Beast. I know who that is. Brian East, give him a round of applause. Excellent job, my friend. Well done. Okay. Was that fun or not? It was? Good. Okay, I figured it wasn't going to be. I think in the new year, Curtis and my Sundays are going to shuffle again so that he's back on family Sundays when we do Cahoots, and I think everybody's going to enjoy the Cahoots more when Curtis is on. All right. So, as always, the purpose of the Cahoot is to have some fun with everybody in here, but it's also to teach us things and remind us of things. And in this particular case, the goal is to remind us of the checkered past that the Jewish people had with kings as they arrived at their advent 2,000 plus years ago. For a time, after the Exodus and entering the Promised Land, the Israelites were essentially a loose confederation of tribes, and they had no king. There were occasional judges, sort of charismatic warrior prophet type people who would step up in important moments and lead or protect the people. But generally speaking, as we read in a recent text, it was a time where everyone did what was right in their own eyes and there was no king. So then the Israelites decided to ask for a king. Both God and the prophet Samuel were at best ambivalent about the idea of the Israelites having a king. God was supposed to be Israel's king, and Samuel told them that up front, if you have a king, there's gonna come a day where that king is going to exploit you and oppress you. He's gonna make you build his palaces and fight in his armies. And they wanted a king anyway, in part because all of the nations around them had a king, and what is a stronger motivation than everyone else is doing it? So God gave them a king named Saul, which is kind of funny because Saul, or Shaul in Hebrew, means to ask. It means question, really. So God is kind of being ironic and funny. You asked for a king? Here's a king named Ask. It kind of feels like God is giving them a permanent reminder that you asked for it. And Saul starts off okay. But then he becomes more and more power hungry and paranoid. And God withdraws his blessing from Saul and anoints David. And then Saul kind of just becomes the foil for David's remarkable rise. And David, at least at the beginning, is better than Saul. And he starts really, really well. He's a warrior and a protector, a musician and a poet, and he's also super dreamy. He begins as a man after God's own heart, but in time, power and privilege gets the best of him too. He steals a man's wife and essentially has the man killed, which sets off a cascade of events which led to violence and rebellion, even in his own family. And he's humbled and repentant late in life, but his legacy is permanently tarnished because of all of that. Then his son Solomon becomes king over Israel, and he is initially known worldwide for his wisdom. And he brings Israel to the zenith of their power and prosperity. But again, power and prosperity get the best of him. As we pointed out earlier, he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. He entered into military and economic agreements with all the nations around them, including Egypt, their former enslavers, which made Israel more wealthy than they had ever been, but also morally and spiritually compromised. When Solomon died, his son Rehoboam became king, and he was from the very beginning immature and arrogant and abusive. Many of the northern tribes of Israel had been the workforce in building Solomon's temple and palaces in Jerusalem. Remember what Samuel said back when they first asked for a king? And when they came to Rehoboam and asked him to ease their workload, he responded by increasing their workload just to spite them, which, by the way, is exactly what Pharaoh did way back in Egypt. So the northern 10 tribes seceded, forming their own kingdom of Israel. So now we have Israel and Judah. And God's people would never again be fully unified. As mentioned, of the 39 kings that ruled over the next several centuries in Israel and Judah, only 4 in the Bible are judged as good, and 5 are like okay. Like they're better than the others, but still pretty bad. All of the rest of them are viewed as unfaithful. They worship other gods. They perpetuate injustice to the poor and the widows and the foreigners. 4/9 out of 39. If you're a baseball fan, that's a batting average of 103 and an on-base percentage of 231 if we count the 5 as walks. So even in baseball, those are terrible stats, much less a sacred commission from God. All this apostasy and injustice leads God to ultimately allow both kingdoms to be conquered. First, the northern kingdom of Israel was conquered in 722 BC by the Assyrians, then the southern kingdom of Judah in 586 BC, ending the Davidic line of kings. And after some time, the Jewish people would return to their homeland. They would rebuild Jerusalem and the temple, albeit in lesser, shabbier forms than they previously existed in. But they would never again truly have a king, or a Davidic king especially. In the 2 centuries before Jesus, they kind of tried. After being oppressed by the Greek Seleucid Empire, a group of Jewish rebels, eventually known as the Maccabees, named after their initial leader, Judah Maccabee, Maccabee in Hebrew meaning hammer. He got that because he wore big pants and had great dance moves. That joke never gets old. I don't care if you laugh at it or not. Okay. They expelled the Greeks from Jerusalem, rededicated the temple, an event celebrated every year now in Hanukkah, and made Judah an independent kingdom again under the Hasmonean dynasty. Now, initially, in the Hasmonean dynasty, most of them knew that they weren't legitimate kings of Israel, so they took titles like prince. But eventually, one day, they became corrupt. They began trying to call themselves kings. They actually took over the claim of the high priesthood for themselves, which again, they weren't allowed to claim. They exploited the religion that their grandfathers had fought to save from Greek oppression. They became rich and arrogant, violent and oppressive, even toward their own people. They fought in civil wars with one another over power, just like the Old Testament kings did, until the Romans came and conquered the land in 63 BC. And this is the story of kingship in Israel. Now here, I think, is the point. When the Jewish people arrived at their advent 2,000 years ago, they had a complex, perhaps even conflicted, relationship with kings. They wanted a king. They needed a king. They were dreaming of a king. They desperately wanted God to act again, to restore his promises of old, to reignite all of their hopes and dreams for who they could be and for their calling in the world. And all of those hopes and dreams were tied up and wrapped up and embodied by the idea of a king. But they also knew how dark and destructive kings could be. How many times they'd been failed by kings, watched their kings become the very thing they had once rescued them from. So in other words, they needed a king. They wanted a king, but they also somewhere deep down knew they needed a different kind of king. I share this quote often because it's one of my favorites. Albert Einstein once said that no problem can be solved from the same level of consciousness that created it. That's what I think of when I think about the type of king that they needed. They needed a king from a different level of consciousness, from something else or somewhere else, a king that could redeem and transform kingship itself. They, of course, didn't know this quite yet, but Jesus was and is that king. In our gospel story today, when Jesus is having that bizarre conversation with Pontius Pilate about whether he is a king, the king of the Jews, something that he certainly is, but that Pilate just can't seem to wrap his head around given the circumstances in front of him, Jesus says something kind of peculiar, but really important and powerful. He says, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jewish leaders, but no, my kingdom is from another place." This verse has at times led to a lot of confusion and even misinterpretation. Sometimes people have taken Jesus to be saying here, when he says his kingdom is not of this world, that he is not interested in this world. To say that he's only interested in abstract spiritual things, not the real physical down-to-earth things of this world right here, right now, but that is not at all what Jesus is saying here. N.T. Wright says this about this verse. He says that his kingdom is not from this world, but it is most definitely for this world. In the Greek, the sentence actually uses the preposition ek, which means forth from, or out of, or proceeding from, like ekklesia, those that are called out from, those that are called forth from, meaning my kingdom does not flow out of this world. It is not born out of this world. This world is not its source, its origin. It is from elsewhere, but it is for here. His kingdom is like a seed from another planet being planted here. It'll grow somehow in this soil, but no plant you've ever seen before can fully prepare you for what it will be, because it is something else from elsewhere. Now, I think there's a really important implication to this. Now, obviously, In a really straightforward way, this means that Jesus' kingdom is supposed to be different from this world and from the kingdoms of this world. But I think if we just stop there with that interpretation, it's a bit too shallow. The word elsewhere or another place here, it usually refers to the origins of something, its place of origins. It refers to its roots, its foundations. In other words, Jesus' kingdom is not just different from the world in the details. It's different in its very fundamentals, in its DNA, in its basic building blocks, in its foundational ideas and perspectives. Jesus doesn't just say, "My kingdom is different from this world." He says it's not from this world. It doesn't flow out of it, which means its very foundations are different. In his book, How God Became King, N.T. Wright says this: "Jesus is often seen as someone who can teach you to play the piano so that you can perform Mozart and Beethoven. But Jesus was more like someone who had just invented an entirely new musical instrument and had written some stunning music for it and was now teaching people to play the new music on the new instrument. Jesus was announcing that a whole new world was being born, and he was teaching people how to live within that whole new world." Sometimes in the church, I think, we interrogate the details of our lives and our hearts without ever interrogating the foundational ideas and assumptions about the world in our hearts, in our minds. We talk about habits, choices, or policies, and positions, and all of those sorts of things without ever touching the deeper places where all of those details flow out of. But it's the deep places that need to be renovated. It's the deep places that need to enter a new kingdom, or the details won't ever matter. If I were to name the fundamental building blocks, the roots, the foundations of the kingdoms of this world, they would be scarcity and fear. The fundamental animating assumption of this world is that there is not enough, and that what we must compete for what little there is. And this extends from the agricultural economies of ancient Israel's world to the attention economy of the 21st century world. And the message that we absorb all along is, we must always be afraid. We must always be afraid. Some of you may know this, I'm really strange about where I sit when I go places. I need to sit with my back to the wall so that I can see everything and everyone else. And my wife is shaking her head because she knows how weird I am about this. I have literally left coffee shops when I was going there to work because there wasn't a seat acceptable. There were seats, but not seats acceptable. You want to know at least partly why I'm that way? It's because in elementary school, I was terrified that if people could see me and I couldn't see them, that they would be talking about me and making fun of me. Even as a child, we're programmed to be afraid. We're programmed to be afraid. But if I were to name the fundamental building blocks of the kingdom of God, they wouldn't be scarcity and fear. They would be grace and gratitude. The gospel is that the creator of the universe loves you personally and loves all of us collectively simply because he chooses to. It was his initiative, his sacrifice. It is a gift, unearned, undeserved. The actual economy of the universe, despite common perception, is a gift economy, not a competition economy. If you're engaging in a competition economy in any way, you are participating in an illusion. Actual reality is not scarcity, but abundance. Not competition, but grace. Which means that our fundamental response to reality should not be fear, but gratitude. You could try to change your choices all day long, but if you don't teach yourself to believe, accept, and trust a universe of grace deep at the center of your being, you will remain imprisoned by the kingdoms of this world. The kingdoms of this world want us to live in fear, to fixate on all the negative stuff. And don't get me wrong, there's plenty of negative stuff. But they want us to fixate on that, on the scarcity, to grasp white-knuckled onto everything so that we don't lose it. But the kingdom that is from somewhere else, it calls us to gratitude. Because in that kingdom, nothing can truly be lost. We are already loved by the very creator of love itself. So, today, as we prepare for Thanksgiving and then Advent and the birth of our King, the King of a different kingdom, a kingdom not from here, instead of me praying to close us, I want to end with an exercise of gratitude. So this is why you got those red sheets of paper when you came in. We're going to take a minute, and I think I'd like to go ahead and call up the worship team. We're going to take a minute, and I want you to take that sheet of paper, and I want you to write down something, or even everything that you can think of that you are grateful for. Write one thing if you want, and write it beautifully, or write a million things as tiny as you can. You can do this however you want to. You could go for quantity or you could go for quality. You could go for poetry or prose, art or a list, whatever you want to do. And what we're going to do is after church, we're going to go make ornaments to put up next week to decorate the church for Advent. And what I want you to do with this sheet of paper is I want you to make it a part of your ornament. I want you to fold it up however you'd like so it's displaying whatever you'd like and put it in your ornament. Put it in your ornament facing out so that we can at least see some of the things that you're grateful for. And again, you can do it however you want. Like if you want to do it and fold it all up so you can't see anything and open it up next year to see what you were thinking right now, that's fine. But we want to do this so that we are surrounded by gratitude this Advent. Amen? Surrounded by gratitude. Because we don't just need to renovate the details of our lives. We've got to renovate our hearts at the deepest level. And that begins with grace and gratitude. So take a minute. They're going to start playing, and then we'll ask you to stand up soon. But write down whatever you are grateful for.
All my words fall short. I've got nothing new. How could I express all my gratitude? I could sing these songs as I often do. Every song must stand.